Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
When I'm looking at the next 12 months of my life, what I do not have on the books and what is impossible for me to have on the books is a trip to Sicily. However, the next best thing to having my own adventure in Sicily was reading Joe Piazza's new novel, The Sicilian Inheritance. It is a vacation in a book. If your vacations were sexy murder mysteries that also dive deep into generational trauma, but not in too heavy of a way, it is the perfect book to take on a plane. It is the perfect book to read next to your public pool while taking breaks to yell at your kids. It is the perfect book to get you out of a reading slump, and it is available now wherever you get books.
My friend Amanda Montell is a very serious multi-hyphenate. She is. I'd like to call her a Renaissance woman. She's a writer, a linguist, a podcast host. She's all of the things. Her past two books have given my brain so much to think about, so much. I mean, I reference her a lot on this podcast and in conversation with friends. I do. You guys might know her from Cultish, The Language of Fanaticism, or A Word Slut, A Feminist Guide to Taking Back the English Language. She is also the creator and host of the hit podcast, Sounds Like a Cult. Her latest book has the best title yet. It does. It really does. I mean, look, I thought Word Slut was great, but The Age of Magical Overthinking, that's really chef's kiss. It is. It is. It's a smart deep dive into how we're all massively irrational beings right now and how that's driving most of us crazy. Yeah. Yeah. But it's also filled with hope. It's filled with hope for the future, hope that we can overcome our irrationality. Or if we can't overcome it, that we can harness it for something good. How do you define modern irrationality?
Okay, great question. Really small, innocent, shallow question. No, I mean, I have been defining modern irrationality with this phrase, magical overthinking, in the following way. What's living rent-free in my head and what has been living rent-free in my head for the past, I don't know, 5 years, is this clash between our innate human mysticisms, our innate penchants toward delusion and jumping to false conclusions and making what are called resource rational, but not perfectly rational decisions, and the information age. There is just this explosive conflict between the ways that our minds learned to process the world around us and the present age when we are confronting more information, true and false, and more identities every day than we ever had to in the history of the human species. And that's just causing us a great deal of existential pain. And so that's how I really define it. It's this age-old magical thinking proclivity combined with all of the overthinking of the modern era.
Well, absolutely. And I say this all the time. Our brains are not equipped for what is happening right now. They're not programmed for this in any way, shape, or form. Everything has just moved too fast. We are not evolving quickly enough. And there is a reason that there is so much anxiety and depression and angst and worry in the world, because our brains can't take it. Someone gave me the best analogy the other day, and I forget who it was. I'll remember it later because my brain is, you know, a big brain fart right now. But it was that their brain, after they spend like too much time on social media, or even not even on social media, just like looking at their phone, responding to texts and, you know, consuming information, feels like a computer when the fan goes on.
That's perfect. That's perfect.
Right. And like, yeah. nothing's operating at full speed. The pages won't load. And like this fan is just blowing an annoying noise at you.
Absolutely.
But famously, and I think that's so true.
Yeah. But famously, we are not computers, right? And yet there is this what I perceive to be almost capitalistic, perfectionistic pressure to know everything under the sun, to be able to clap back with a cogent rejoinder. And at the very same time, there's more mistrust in science than ever. There is actually evidence to support that as science literacy increases, it just makes us better at defending our existing beliefs rather than discerning real facts and discarding fake ones. So there's a lot going on. We as human beings have these deep-rooted mental magic tricks, these imperfect shortcuts that we've always used to make decisions called cognitive biases that are just proving destructive with the modern, ever complicating, ever technologically driven problems. And we're not computers. So, and yet we don't realize that. There is actually evidence to support that we fail to recognize where our knowledge ends and Google's or ChatGPT's starts. So these like borders are becoming ever hazy, and yet we're not aware that they are.
Oh, interesting. I had no idea about that. So we have a very hard time distinguishing between our own brain and what is available on Google.
Dude, it's actually called the Google effect. It's fascinating. There are just these incredibly hazy knowledge barriers that we have. So for example, like there's this fascinating 2017 book called The Knowledge Illusion by Philip Fernbach and Stephen Sloman. And it opened with this Yale study in which graduate students were invited to rate how well they understood ordinary everyday gadgets like toilets and zippers. And then they were asked to write thorough bit-by-bit breakdowns of how those gadgets worked and rate their understanding once more. And what the task seemed to do was show the students their own ignorance, because after they actually had to break down how these gadgets work, they realized like, oh, I actually don't know. I thought I did and I don't. The reason why we think we know more than we do about how toilets and zippers work is because of other people's specialization, of other people's knowledge. We can't tell where the boundary of our knowledge stops and another person starts. But the wild thing is that we can't even identify where search engines' knowledge starts and ours drops off. And you know, obviously AI, which is combining like everybody's knowledge to provide an answer to a question, is making those knowledge pools even more porous. So yeah, it's called the Google effect, and it's so troubling and interesting and explains a lot.
Well, you know, you are so genuinely good at taking science and distilling it and, you know, telling us like these studies and how, like, what is really happening to our brains. What was one of the things that, like, blew your fucking mind when you were researching this book?
Oh, my God. Okay, so there's one chapter of the book. And by the way, every chapter of the book is kind of dedicated to a different cognitive bias, which I use as a lens to explore some mysterious irrationality plaguing the broader zeitgeist in my own life. But there's this one chapter dedicated to the sunk cost fallacy, which describes our fallacious penchant to think that resources already spent on an endeavor justify spending even more. So, you know, a classic example is we put all our chips on the table in a poker hand. And even though our hand is really bad, we figure like, oh, my God, I've already put so much on the table. I can't fold now. I have to go all in. That is the sunk cost fallacy at work. But it also applies to human relationships. And in that chapter, I document how the sunk cost fallacy caused me to stay in a pretty toxic one-on-one cult-like relationship, if you will, longer than made sense to anyone else and even me. And as I was researching that chapter, I came across this fascinating study about additive solution bias versus subtractive solution bias, which basically describes our tendency to think that problems should be solved by adding variables to the equation rather than taking them away. So the study that I quoted involved participants solving this puzzle involving colored blocks by either adding or taking away colored blocks. And as it turned out, the more cumbersome solution to this like spatial puzzle would be by adding a whole bunch of colored blocks. The much more simple solution was simply taking one block away, but the vast majority of people opted for the additive solution. And I've found that I do this in every arena of life. Like, in order to solve my relationship problems, I thought, oh, we just need to add a new vacation, or we just need to get another cat. I don't regret any of my cats. They don't, but they didn't solve my relationship problems. when really the solution was simply to take that person away. And so I feel like this applies to so many aspects of my life, from, you know, how I deal with my junk drawer. I think like, oh, I need to get like some drawer dividers and some like organizational apparatus. I would really, I just need to throw shit away. So that was one that truly lives rent free in my head and allows me to make better decisions moving forward in so many arenas of life.
Less stuff. We just need less stuff. But also, I mean, that perfectly explains why people have save the marriage babies, right?
Exactly.
They're like, oh, if we just have another baby, that's going to fix the fact that we hate each other.
Completely. And it also explains why during the most painful moments in that past relationship, I would just blitz my Instagram with happy looking photos of us. I was like, I just need to like justify this relationship with more evidence that it's a good thing, when the reality is that it wasn't. And I was just sort of falling to the sunk cost fallacy. And that was really healing to learn as well, because it meant that I was not just some ding dong who made a bad bet on herself that she couldn't shake. You know, there were these mental magic tricks at play. But yes, that like save a marriage baby thing is so real. And I think this bias especially affects people who grow up in consumerist societies, who are led to believe the false promise that adding a gadget or a baby or a vacation will magically heal your woes.
Totally, totally. We are going to take a quick break here. And when we get back, we are going to talk about a chapter called Are You My Mother, Taylor Swift? Under the Influence is brought to you by Honeylove, my favorite shapewear of all time. It really is. I can talk about Honeylove all day long because it's truly that excellent. Yes, the Honeylove bra is the one that I'm wearing in my author photos. Yep, just wearing a bra under a hot pink blazer, because you know what? I've got some big Sicilian energy. I do. And Honeylove gives me that. It gives me this confidence to just strut around like a bold, brash goddess. Yeah. I know that sounds like hyperbole, but have you seen my author photos? They are freaking hot, my friends. They are. And as I start packing for the Sicilian Inheritance book tour, you know that I'm bringing my Honeylove shorts and my Honeylove bra, because I'm going to tuck it all in where I want to be tucked. I have so many gross old bras in my drawers that I know it's time to throw them out. It's time to make space. And I am vowing to spring clean my underwear drawer. I am. I'm going to finally get rid of that Patagonia bra from 2012. If you too are going to spring clean your underwear drawer, why not grab yourself some Honeylove? You can get 20% off your entire order with our exclusive link, honeylove.com/influence. So to support our show, check them out at honeylove.com/influence. Treat yourself to Honeylove. You deserve it. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, and I am very much a parent, you have your fair share of big talks with your kids, especially if your kids happen to read your very adult novels because they're an advanced reader and you just can't rip it out of their grubby hands. But that is another story altogether. One of those big talks that you should be having is about money. I talk to my kids about money all the time because it is something that my parents didn't talk about with me. Greenlight can definitely help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app made for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I have recently started doing an allowance for my 6-year-old, and he loves it. He also loves doing chores for money. Like, I do not think that we can start them too early these days. And Greenlight makes it very easy for him to see exactly how much money he is making for which chores. It also helps my kids, even the four-year-old here, build financial literacy and independence by learning how to earn, save, and spend wisely. The Greenlight app also comes with an in-app financial literacy game called Level Up that helps kids build money confidence through videos, bite-sized challenges, mini games, and more. More than 6 million parents and kids use Greenlight to learn how to make responsible financial choices, and I am all in. I'm having a good time with it. I tried a lot of allowance apps, and many of them were very, very bad. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/influence. That's greenlight.com/influence to try Greenlight for free. greenlight.com/influence. I want to talk about the halo effect next, because I think it's really pertinent to a lot of the things that we talk about on this show, particularly influencer culture and celebrity culture. And I mean, those two are the same things at this point. Tell me about the halo effect.
Yeah. So the halo effect is the cognitive bias that I tackle in the first chapter of this book, which is called Are You My Mother, Taylor Swift? And it describes this very simple but illuminating idea where just because we admire one single quality in a person, say their fashion sense or their intelligence or their vocabulary or their pop music, we jump to the conclusion that they must be perfect overall. And this bias stems from the ways that we used to find role models in ancient human civilization for survival purposes. We used to see someone with big muscles and we jump to the conclusion that that person must be a skilled hunter and a really good survivor and someone that we would want to align ourselves with so that we could live longer as well, even if those muscles didn't indicate that exactly. It was a good enough conclusion to jump to. But now we're displacing that bias onto modern parasocial relationships, and that's causing these ever-intensifying cycles of celebrity worship and dethronement.
Yeah, and though, I mean, those cycles are really, really intense. For our listeners who don't know what parasocial relationships are, it's funny. I thought everyone knew what they were, but I was at a wedding in Mexico this weekend and someone stopped me when I said the word parasocial and they were like, can you define that for me? And I was like, huh, what rock have you been living under? But define it just in case.
Huh. I generously would love to believe that someone who doesn't even know what a parasocial relationship is, they're either so entrenched in one that they like have never even thought to Google if it was a problem, or they're not in one at all and have never even heard of it and don't own an Instagram.
No, they were totally in one. That's the thing. I described it. And she's like, oh, that's the exact relationship I have with this influencer. And I was like, bingo.
Yeah, totally. Okay, so a parasocial relationship is basically this one-sided, intimate relationship where one person in the equation is extending all this emotional bandwidth, interest, time in the other figure who doesn't even know they exist. So the reason why I call that chapter Are You My Mother, Taylor Swift is because we are really seeking connection from celebrities in today's society. And of course, I would put influencers in that category. We are longing for a type of intimacy and role models, and we're longing to trust someone in a time when we've lost a lot of trust in authority figures like the government and the healthcare institution. We're looking for another kind of paragon. And basically, ever since the 1980s, celebrities have been positioned as this type of figure that's not just there to entertain us, they're there to save us. And we can really trace that back to Ronald Reagan's presidency, our first celebrity president. He really swerved way far out of his lane to provide, you know, this new kind of authority figure for society. And obviously, like, there are still people who really worship him and lionize his presidency. And basically, ever since then, we've looked to celebrities as our political paragons, our spiritual authorities, our political higher-ups, and in a way, our mothers. Like, we are seeking this intimacy from them that simply cannot be fulfilled, that simply cannot be returned. But again, those fuzzy brain boundaries that I was describing earlier deceive us.
Totally, totally. They really do. And I think that this gets dangerous with the world of influencers. And I say this a lot. So I'm curious if I'm just spouting bullshit out my ass or what you think of it. But for a long time, we did look up to celebrities like this. And there is a certain danger in having those parasocial relationships. But influencers feel more dangerous because they're with us all the time. They're like on this device that's literally attached to our body. I've been thinking a lot lately when I pick up my phone to like go to the bathroom or pick up my phone to just go up the stairs for a minute. I'm like, why do I have to touch this thing all the time? Like, why has it become an appendage? And it has. And these influencers are literally right there with us all the time. And that feels dangerous in some ways to me.
Right. Well, I think it's really a product of the medium. And I almost don't even blame the influencers as much as I blame these tech companies who
are exploiting.
Right. Yeah. Causing us to form quite literally addictions to these devices. But the difference between an influencer and a celebrity is that if social media disappeared tomorrow, we would still have an awareness of celebrities like Taylor Swift or Beyonce or Charlie XCX. We would still see them on our televisions. We would still listen to their music on Spotify or our listening platform of choice. But influencers only exist on platforms that are psychologically addicting. And I am totally resentful of the psychological dependence that I have on Instagram. I really try to take detox breaks. Of course, I use Instagram as a marketing tool, so it becomes like really difficult to abandon it. Yeah, for my livelihood. But I do aspire to a day when maybe I can absorb maybe one lumen of Taylor Swift's halo and defect from social media and not suffer any monetary consequences from it. But yeah, I think influencers only exist on these platforms that are really screwing with our dopamine. And that's why they seem more insidious than celebrities.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I aspire to a day when I can fully quit the Instagram. And I'm not saying I have to quit it forever. I really, really don't want to be on it for a chunk of time. It's actually impossible right now,
but
mostly because I'm using it almost as like an email platform. Like people send me messages on the Instagram, and it's how I reach readers. I'm sure you experience this too. You know, more people buy the book when they see it on social media than they do in a magazine article now.
I know. That's what makes it so impossible to leave as like, I mean, I would consider an author like a small business owner, you know, like we have our business.
Absolutely,
And it's, you know, this is the double-edged sword of social media is that, you know, there's such a low barrier to entry and it's really democratized a lot of information and it really has, you know, stuck to its original promise of allowing us to socially connect, but the fallout is so damaging to our mental health and to our society and to our political system that I've kind of come to the conclusion at this point that it's a bit of a net negative, while also realizing that it provides such an important platform for us to engage in grassroots activism and discourse that we might not otherwise be able to engage in and community solidarity. But it's, oh God, a double-edged sword is like the most innocent way to put how I feel about it.
It's the most innocent way to put how I feel about it because, you know, people did engage in civic activism before these things existed too. Like, you know, the world is always going to be a mess and the world is also always going to be fine, I guess, is the way that I put it, right? Like,
yeah.
I genuinely don't believe the benefits outweigh the costs, but also I can't get off the train right now.
I'm with you.
It's funny because as I write novels these days, I'm kind of desperate to set everything in 1993.
That's funny. What was happening in your life in 1993?
Well, I was an awesome 13-year-old. But in 1993 or even 1998, I want to set it on the like pre-internet because I mean, that's definitely pre-social media. It's pre-smartphone. I had a flip phone around 99, 2000. But I think it's so much more fun to be able to write when you don't have to write technology into the book. And also to go back to, you know, the first chapter of your book that we talked about, when we don't have to write characters who have access to all knowledge.
Right. Yeah, I was actually going to ask you, because as a novel writer, you must have to enter like a dreamier headspace than most. And I find that social media really threatens my ability to dream. Like when I'm always consuming, it inhibits my ability to create, at least for me. And so I was curious about like how you are able to stay in that dreamy headspace that's so important for novel writing while at the same time being so very online.
Well, it's tough. And I will say I'm working on two new novels right now, even though every time I write a book, I say that I'm going to quit because I hate the marketing process so much.
Yeah.
I'm like, this is it. This is my last one. And Nick is like, you've said that for 7 books, Joe. I'm like, no. I'm like, this is it. That said, I'm working on 2 other novels. And I've been online so much for the promoting phase of Sicilian Inheritance that my brain is so fried that I'm not writing well right
now.
Yeah. I will have to be off before I can pick them back up, and that will be fine. For me, the problem with writing books in the space of when, you know, everyone has all knowledge of everything, it's that plot points are harder to hash out. Sicilian Inheritance is a thriller, right? So we need to have gaps in knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And I think thrillers are a lot harder to pace when you can find out everything with the click of one button.
Totally, totally. Yeah, I love that notion. And I actually aspire to write fiction next. I do have a novel idea that I've been outlining for about a year, but it takes place actually in the near future. And so I feel like that's a way to kind of get around technology as well, because I can kind of play fast and loose with what that will look like. I really like how movies like Her and Arrival treat the future, because it's like very sort of like high end sci-fi that doesn't need to get like too in the weeds of how technology is working, but use it as a kind of vehicle to create meaning in a new way. But what I will say about your attraction to that just before like smartphone era is I have an op-ed coming out in the LA Times about creating nostalgia for the present. And for that op-ed, I interviewed this guy named Clay Routledge, who studies nostalgia. He wrote a book called Past Forward. He's a psychologist, interesting dude. And he cited this 2023 Harris poll, which found that Americans across generations, even Gen Z, are all nostalgic for a time before smartphones, which doesn't mean that we earnestly wish to time travel backwards or that we even want to give up on these phones. It's rather that no matter what our age is, no matter when we were born, we are recognizing that there's something in these phones that's making us stressed, that's like ruining the plot, not just of our novels, but of our lives. And that they're preventing us from like maintaining the kind of deep personal relationships that we truly find meaningful and that we truly have nostalgia for later. So yeah, that nostalgia for like the early to late 90s is omnipresent, really.
It really is. And I think that there's a lot of misplaced nostalgia. Is there a cat back there?
Yeah, I'm gonna let her out. Please.
That's so funny, because we were on a plane coming back from Mexico and someone had 2 cats right behind us, but I wasn't sure if it was a cat or a baby at first.
Yeah. Some of their meows are like really human.
Yeah, and I'm like newborn baby or angry cat. It could have gone either way. I think about this all the time because, you know, I cover trad wives a lot. And I think there's a lot of misplaced nostalgia for what the world was like in the 50s. It's like a 1950s society that never really existed.
100%. Like
absolutely. And maybe I have a false nostalgia for the 90s, but I'll tell you, I do think that life was better before smartphones in a
you
lot
know
of
what?
Different ways.
I will say this. There is a lot of very weaponized nostalgia right now. I think trad wives and political figures take advantage of the nostalgia that we very innocently and positively lean on during difficult times. They will harness that by creating these fantasies that the past was better in every way, a past that, by the way, absolutely did not exist. And even if it did, would not have been better. And they do that for their own personal gain by then being able to catastrophize and say, like, you know, life is worse now than it was then. And I have the answers to make it better, either through my political policies or by following me and adopting my trad wife trends. But I will say more encouragingly that the kind of personal nostalgia that we might feel for our own real memories, not memories that have been like implanted by these nefarious figures, actual nostalgia for our own memories, as sort of Delulu as it might be at times, does help us generate hope for the future. Like when we sink into that warm bath of like fuzzy feelings about prior years, we're able to better cope with what's to come. Studies consistently find that. So it's really when others are weaponizing and capitalizing upon what's called historical nostalgia, or for nostalgia for a time that we never knew, like that's when it really gets dangerous.
Yeah. No, I mean, I 100% agree. I do. And I would also like to note that I probably don't want a beeper again. Like, was there any more useless tool than a beeper?
So it's anything to just like beep aimlessly at them. It's like, I don't know what happened.
Then it was also like, oh, now I've got to find a payphone while I'm drinking 40s in the parking lot of the mall. That's annoying.
Oh, God. Beepers just make me think of that Seventh Heaven episode where, like, the eldest son, Matt, gets his beeper confiscated and gets suspended for being a fake drug dealer. I don't even know. Wow. What a show that was.
You know, there were so many shows in the 80s and 90s about children whose mothers died. And they were, like, taken in by other people. Full House, My Two Dads, Seventh Heaven.
Oh, basically every Mary-Kate and Ashley movie ever.
All of them. Dead moms all around. Dead moms
so
all around.
Dead moms.
Yes. So many dead moms.
Dead mom. Yeah. So many.
Family
Stone.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yes. With Diane Keaton dying, I can't even. We don't watch Julia Roberts movies in our house because she did bail on Charlotte Walsh, likes to win the TV show. At a very late stage in the process. And so I've banned Julia Roberts movies in our house, but it does make me sad sometimes that I'll never see Stepmom again.
Well, sometimes it's our prerogative to cancel people and stick to our guns, even when it doesn't really make sense.
No, because I'm not a quitter. Not like Julia Roberts. Julia Roberts is a quitter and I am not.
Yeah. Dig those heels in. Dig those in.
Totally irrationally. Again, we're irrational beings. Okay, we are going to take a quick break here. And when we get back, I'm going to ask Amanda about ways we can feel better about this dumpster fire. So in the book, let's not give any spoilers, but do you have solutions? How can we feel better?
Yeah, I mean, I am not your self-help guru, famously. I really like to present the information about these subject matters, whether it's cognitive biases or cult language or language and gender, and then kind of personalize them and make them fun to learn about. And maybe sprinkle some actionable advice in here and there, but kind of leave people to draw their own conclusions. But what I will say is this, some of the things that have helped me are, first of all, just merely the awareness, like becoming aware of these mental shortcuts that we don't even know we're making has helped me push back against them in moments when I would otherwise truly allow them to take over. And then it has also helped me generate compassion for other people's irrationalities when I kind of want to write off other people as these like Delulu evil ding-dongs. I'm able to recognize, oh no, that's, you know, that is, say, zero-sum bias at play, or that is the IKEA effect at play. And that allows me not to make too many enemies because I'm able to recognize these biases not only in myself, but in other people. And then in terms of like more concrete advice, there are some fun facts in the book, like, you know, knitting is shown to increase happiness in depressive patients. We really, really benefit in material ways from experiencing senses of awe whenever possible. Awe is this sort of humbling wonder that you experience when you're presented with phenomena that you don't quite understand. So it's something that we experience when beholding nature or beautiful live music or even spiritual rituals. I have all kinds of thoughts on the range of spiritual rituals and how good or bad they might be. But anyway, but experiencing awe really helps us sort of dampen our self-focus. All the self-focus in modern society is, I think, really destructive to our mental health. And so being able to be in that humbling state of awe sort of sets us aside from ourselves and is shown to make us feel less materialistic, is shown to expand our sense of time so we don't feel this panic that we're running out of time. And so, you know, those are some experiences that I try to prioritize, you know, sort of like physical DIY experiences. I am a terrible crafter, but doing things with your hands, I feel like really is meditative and has that same effect of getting you outside yourself and then experiencing awe truly whenever possible.
Oh, you know, you're right. And I read that recent book about experiencing awe and it was great. What was it called? Everything blends together.
Well, there's a great one called Awe by Dr. Keltner. His book is one that I reference in mine also. And he's like an awe scholar, which is a great field to pursue.
Yeah. I know. Could I be an awe scholar? Like maybe that's my next job. We are a household that prioritizes awe. Six and a half years ago, we went to go see the total solar eclipse of the sun. We went to Eastern Oregon, a town called Fossil, and camped in an old rodeo ground with a 7-week-old baby, by the way.
Wow.
I know. And it was so awe-inspiring that we were like, we will be people that travel for eclipses now. That's who we are.
Absolutely love that. And I totally co-sign that. I similarly am obsessed with space. Like my partner and I watch so many space videos. I'm not recommending this. I'm just telling a personal tale. We love to take edibles and watch space explainer videos, like science explainer videos on YouTube, because it makes us feel so small in a good way, takes us outside of ourselves. I fucking love planetariums. I always fantasize that if I were like fabulously wealthy, I would build one of those like float tanks, you know, all those like sensory deprivation chambers or float tanks. But instead of it being true sensory deprivation where it's perfectly dark, I would build it in a domed room with a planetarium on top. And I would float through space when feeling sad.
Totes my goats. Like, that is good. I have dismantled my entire Sicilian Inheritance book tour because of this eclipse. Because I promised 7 years ago in a postpartum and also champagne-induced haze that I would be present for the next one. We'll be in Cleveland the week after my book comes out for the total solar eclipse of the sun. Because I'm me. I've planned a book event in Cleveland to coincide with the solar eclipse with the Italian-American community there. So if you're in Cleveland,
come hang out with me. You know, Sicily is the most mystical place ever. And to kind of tie our books together, you might have noticed that in literally like the first paragraph or at least the first page of my book, I actually reference something that a Sicilian farmer told me when I was there last year about space.
I remember when you were there on that trip. I remember watching your Instagram.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it was so awe-inspiring. I just had to share it. I mean, that's like when I feel like I'm using Instagram for good, is when I'm just kind of like using it as a kind of like Tumblr-esque diary and not using it to socially compare myself into misery. But anywho, I was in Sicily picking herbs and
I pick herbs there all the time. Well, you know, like so many herbs just grow like on the side of the road there. Like there's so much wild parsley and thyme. Yeah, I mean, there's a reason they're olive oil. Their olive oil is the best. I brought a whole suitcase back for the trip. I just got back two weeks ago, 10 days ago. I don't know. What is time? I took an extra suitcase and filled it with olive oil.
I absolutely respect that and should have done that.
You should have. Lessons from Joe.
Yeah, life lesson next time. But so I was on this farm and the farmer was a woman. I feel the need to call that out. And she was giving us a tour of her farm. And at one point she showed us this like stargazing area that she had recently constructed. And she said the following, which was so poetic. I nearly fainted the second it left her mouth. She went, "Here in Sicily, the stars, they are so close, they could fall into your mouth." I was like, oh my God, because there's so little light pollution there. The stars are so close, they could fall into your mouth.
Oh my God.
Like, hell yeah, lady. Yep. That's the awe I'm looking for.
That's the awe I'm looking for. I've got one more. So the Sicilian Inheritance was mostly written when I went back last summer with my three children under the age of 7, which was intense.
Oh my, yes. But
what I really wanted to do with that trip is make the food come alive even more. So I would sit with my laptop and just eat and write while I ate. And then I would walk around the restaurant and ask people to describe their food. And you might think that this is strange, but no one there did. They were totally okay with it. And I was like, what does that squid ink pasta taste like to you? And someone was like, it tastes like eating the ocean.
Wow. Yes. Yes,
like,
I love
yeah, it. Yeah, it does. Fuck yeah.
Dude, like the way that it is a perfectly acceptable conversation topic to just like talk about food for 2 hours in Italy. You don't have to talk about anything else. You don't have to, you know, pitch yourself as cool or having amazing ideas about society. In Italy, you can just talk about food for 2 hours. And that's like delightful and acceptable. And I just love that it like sets everyone up for success because there's no such thing as being right or wrong.
No, it's like, what'd you eat? You know, so much in America, the first thing you ask someone is, one, how are you today? Which is a fraught question, or you lie when you answer it. Or, you know, when you're meeting someone new at a party, it's like, what do you do?
What do you do?
And in Sicily, they're like, what'd you eat for lunch?
Exactly. I know this to be so, so true. It's wild. Yeah. Like every time I would greet someone who I already knew or literally just meet someone for the first time in Italy, they would be like, what'd you eat?
What'd you eat today? And I'm like, oh, let me tell you about this cannoli that I had for breakfast.
Oh, God. You know what? Scrap everything I'm saying about like, oh, nature. Just eat tortelloni every day.
Every fucking day. Okay. Yeah. I know. Yeah. I love it. I love it so much. And I love your book. I do. I want everyone.
Thank you.
It gave me so much reassurance about the irrationality of the world right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's the warm bath that we all need to jump into.
I appreciate that. That means so much for me. I like admire you and your writing and everything you do on the internet so much. It's like really inspiring and encouraging to see someone like just be so enthusiastic all the time in the way that I feel like sometimes I feel like a tryhard and I feel like overly earnest. And then I see someone I feel like is cut from the same cloth who's doing it so well. And it makes me feel really reassured. So thank you.
Oh, no, I love following you and I love all of your writing and your podcasts and all the stuff. And we need to go to Sicily together one of these days is
Listen.
What we got to get good.
Mm-hmm. What's your favorite? Where's your favorite town in Sicily?
It's really interesting. So my family is from Caltabolotto, which is a tiny village closer to the western coast. So I spend a lot of time on the west coast. And I know like, you know, Taormina in the east coast is much more popular. But there's a little island called Marettimo, which is one of the Agadi Islands. And you get to it, you can go from Sciacca, you can go from Trapani. And it's an island with no cars. It's teeny tiny. There's two restaurants on it. You have to stay in someone's house. And it's just, you get on a boat to do the Giro di Isola, the ride around the island with a man named Pippo. And his company is literally called Pippo. And it's just, it's a perfect place. But I love all of the towns over there. Caltabolotta is so cool in so many ways. There's only 500 people left in the town, but
wow.
The people in our generation are really trying. So Giuseppe, whose parents own the one restaurant in town, is now opening a vineyard and a winery. And it's cool to watch people like help these towns come alive. Because for a long time, a lot of people left and didn't come back.
Yeah. Yeah. No, there really is. Oh, my gosh. I saw some funny meme the other day where it's like, my Sicilian grandparents like broke their backs to come to America only for me to long for nothing more than to return to Sicily.
I
do love that people are embracing their roots, particularly there. Even just talking about Sicily feels really soothing to me. I don't know if you've ever been to Syracuse.
Oh, yeah. I love Syracuse. God. Yeah, yeah.
That place is so fucking mystical. I mean, I remember the first time I stumbled from one of those little tiny skinny Greek style alleyways into the main piazza there. I nearly lost my life. I remember being like wandering into cafes being like, questa piazza è stupenda. Like everyone's like, yeah, it's really cool here.
They're like, we know. Yeah.
Like, oh God, it's delish.
I love Sicily so much. I've been probably like a dozen times at this point. And the goal of the book is just to make everyone want to go there. I'm like, the Sicilian Tourism Board should really be sponsoring me because...
Wait, so are you a citizen?
I'm working on it right now. So when I was over there last time, I got all of the documents that I need to be able to apply for Italian citizenship. I'm making my appointment at the consulate here. And it seems like it's going to work. One of my cousins just got her passport. And once I get it, it then extends to my husband and my three very blonde, non-Italian looking children.
I love that. I really want to try to pursue it for myself. I had a great grandfather from a tiny town. You know, my last name actually is supposed to be Maffattone.
Oh, my God. I love that.
Maffattone. Yeah. Which is a lot. And it's funny because that suffix one means like big. And big, I'm 5'1". Yeah.
And you're a tiny person.
I'm a small person. But yeah, there's a tiny Southern Sicilian town where actually the current mayor, their last name is Maffattone, which is very funny.
Oh, my God.
But I really want to pursue that also because my favorite place to be in Italy is in Bologna.
I love Bologna.
Oh God, I fucking love it there. And so I wanna, you know, be a little here, a little there.
Well, let me know if you need help because when I was working on the true crime podcast, that's the companion to the Sicilian Inheritance, where I solved the actual murder of my great great grandmother, because I'm a psychopath. We hired a researcher named Laura Lee, and her company is Digging Up Roots in the Boot.
Cool.
And I know, right? I'm like, that name is genius. And she helped us do so much archival research. She's a genius. But her other business is helping people get citizenship. So she can tell you immediately, one, if it's possible, because she knows all the weird rules. And then two, you can hire her to actually go get the documents for you, which is very helpful.
Oh, I love a delegation. I love an outsource. Keep her in your little back pocket, finding the roots in the boot.
Mm-hmm. Yep, find the roots in the boot. All right, tell everyone where they can find you.
Well, you can pre-order my book, The Age of Magical Overthinking, wherever books are sold. It's also on audiobook, and I recorded it myself, which was such a joy. And then I'm also going on this kind of extravagant book tour where half of the events are actually this live variety show podcaster extravaganza, where there will be special guests like Kelsey McKinney from Normal Gossip and Kira N. Griff from the Petty Crimes podcast. And oh my God, Joe, I would love for you to come because I'm doing one in Philly.
Oh. When is it?
It's on April 16th.
I'll be back. I'll be back from my book tour. I'll come.
I will put you on the comp list. I would love for you to come.
Yeah.
It's going to be a hoot. It's going to be like a PowerPoint presentation and drag performances. It's going to be like such a party. So I would love for people who live in LA, Boston, Philly, New York, Portland to check out my book tour at amandamontel.com/events. And then, of course, I have my podcast, Sounds Like a Cult. And I'm actually launching a new podcast in conjunction with the new book called Magical Overthinkers, which will be out in May. So that's all my stuff.
All your stuff. I love it. I love it so much. Thank you for coming on Under the Influence.
Always a pleasure.
And that is all we have for today. Talking to Amanda just makes me feel smarter. And I love people that make me feel smarter. It's just the best. Because frankly, there's too many people who make you feel dumber in this world. That's a cheery thought. Go grab yourself a copy of The Age of Magical Overthinking. The cover's real good. It looks real good on Instagram. It really does. It does. Grab some Sicilian inheritances for you, your friends, your barista at Starbucks, and then go do something nice for yourself, because you deserve it. Bye.